So tonight we're going to continue with the in-depth study of my newest book, Oneness, the Cosmic Perspective, the Three Principles of Oneness. And tonight's chapter is called The New Emergent Myth. And because I was having such difficulty last time, I brought my cool blue reading glasses. Pretty cool. So there's three quotes tonight. The first is from Carl Sagan. Science is not only compatible with spirituality, it is a profound source of spirituality. When we recognize our place in the immensity of light years and in the passage of ages, when we grasp the intricacy, beauty, and subtlety of life, then that soaring feeling, that sense of elation and humility combined, is surely spiritual. The notion that science and spirituality are somehow mutually exclusive does a disservice to both. Next quote is by Joseph Campbell. Mythology opens the world so that it becomes transparent to something that is beyond speech, beyond words, in short, what we call transcendence. Without that, you don't have a mythology. Any system of thinking, ideologies of one kind or another, that does not open to the transcendence, cannot be understood or classified mythologically. And finally, Wolfgang Pauli. I consider the ambition of overcoming opposites, including also a synthesis embracing both rational understanding and the mystical experience of unity, to be the mythos, spoken or unspoken, of our present day and age. So, what I want to start out by doing is talk about what myth is. Because we have this popular pedestrian use of the word myth, which is really not correct. And, you know, scholars or academics would differentiate what we would call a Pickwickian myth from a Socratic myth. So the Socratic myth is what we'll be referring to tonight. The Pickwickian sense of it is when someone says that it's not true and uses the word myth to talk about something fanciful that's not true. That's just a myth, right? And it's interesting how words come into our language and their meaning can change. You know, for example, the expression to pull oneself up by one's bootstraps was originally a term of humor, right? Because if you've ever tried it, it's very difficult. Some people say it's impossible, but I actually accomplished it once. But it takes a lot of effort, a lot of practice to physically pull yourself up by these straps. It's really interesting. You gotta use your knees too. But then it was used many, many, many years ago to refer to the idea of someone who was going to step away from the conformity of the crowd and was not going to be dependent on the desires of others, but would be free and would choose that freedom. And so that expression of pulling oneself up by one's bootstraps changed and became a positive thing. So likewise, the word myth has had some different meanings in our popular usage. But we're going to stick with the Socratic version because that's really the correct one. So what is a myth? Well, there's a lot of different ways you can talk about it. I think of myth as the way that the cosmos makes itself known in our culture. In human culture, or you might say sentient culture. So it's the way the cosmos is made known in sentient culture. And it's a way to talk about the great mystery of existence. It's a way of explaining the unexplainable. And the language is always mystical. And further, a myth teaches us principles of reality that are beyond personal opinion or cultural opinion. In other words, no matter how the myth manifests in human culture, it is expressing something that's beyond the opinion of one person or one group. It's transcendent. It draws us out into transcendence. And these principles can become symbol systems that metaphorically unlock in us the potentials of human life. That's what it is. Now, what happens with myth is that through time, different experiences come into play. And the mistake that people make with myth, and I think this is kind of where it got misconstrued as maybe something that's not true. Oh, by the way, I'm wearing my cosmic bomb of the solar system. The reason it kind of fell into that is because what happens with myth is that people tend to literalize it. They try to turn myth into something literal. They try to turn myth into something fixed in some linear sense of time. And when you do that, well, you're going to find that the language of myth may not hold up. So if I happen to have a mythology that comes into conflict with our myth, the new myth, and part of that new myth is science, when that old idea comes into conflict with science, people usually do one of two things. They either reject the science, the knowledge that we have now, or they hold dogmatically and in a fundamentalistic way to the imagery of the myth. And both are wrong. Both are not clear. Both are incorrect. So the name of this talk is the four functions of myth and how these things can reveal the new mythos of our time, at least what I believe is the new mythos of our time. And it's not just me. The people that I quoted there, Carl Sagan, Joseph Campbell, Wolfgang Pauli, the great physicist, and there are plenty of folks today, they're all seeing it. Because the thing about a myth is, it emerges. In other words, you're not really creating it. Now, you might assist it in the way that it manifests, but it's kind of manifesting on its own. And it emerges through the great cosmic principle of change that we call evolution. And evolution helps things to emerge in a certain way so that it meets the needs of the time and space that you find yourself in. But what happens when someone tries to hold on to that old idea is that the affect image, in other words, the things that really, when you saw it and looked at it, it just drew you out, it starts to go away. Without going into too much detail, it's because of the fact that sentient beings project psychologically. They're always projecting what's within them out onto the world. And when there's conflict within, then that projection can no longer be carried by that object. And you see this throughout history, where the object loses its affect imagery. In the book, I talk about how this happened to the American Indian. The American Indian began to lose its affect imagery. And this was largely due to the fact that even though American Indian groups were constantly at war, constantly taking over each other, constantly enslaving each other, there was a bigger group that came in with more powerful weapons and took them over. And that's what always happens. That's why whenever we talk about aliens, I sure hope they're Vulcans and not Klingons. I said to my son the other day, what a great science fiction story, right? Take sort of the American Indian story and how that happened in the Old West and just apply it to an alien montage, right? And so what happens is that imagery is lost. And for some of the American Indians, the buffalo was that symbol. And when the buffalo was no longer there, they actually tried to bring in and adapt. And so they actually ironically brought in some Christian imagery and started to use language that sounded much more like what the dominant Christians were using. And they created the ghost dance. And they created these things that they thought would bring all the tribes together under this common oppression of this new conqueror. And they tried. And it was a way to try to bring back the old. Didn't work. In our culture, because of the way within which science was beginning to sort of replace all our old ways of knowing, and then we had all those wars. By the time you get into the 60s and 70s, the affect images that once drew us out into the transcendent began to lose their mass appeal. And new images emerged. It's not an accident that the affect image of the seated, peaceful Buddha has become so ubiquitous. Lots of people will go down to the corner store, and if they have a garden supply place, there'll be lots of Buddhas. And people who have no connection to Buddhism will proudly put that Buddha there. Why? Just because it's sexy? Maybe. I don't know if you call Hote sexy or not. Depends what you're good for. But it's drawing us. And what's fascinating is there have been actual studies that have shown that the image of the Buddha, if you take a classroom and you show them all the traditional images of religion, everything from, the Islamic crescent to the Christian cross, and you ask them very quickly to note, on a scale, how positive is this image for you? Guess which one wins every time. Part of the reason I'm a Buddhist is not because the cosmos can't speak through all kinds of different vehicles. I just found this one to be the one that was emerging. And so I linked myself with that because of that reality. And so what you find in a culture that's going through this change is that you find folks that are trying very hard to hold on to images and to concepts that are just not meeting what we know. And we're never gonna undo that. In other words, the knowledge that science has given us, the natural scientists like Sir Francis Bacon and others that emerged out of the Renaissance and the Reformation, the revolutions, and they emerged in this new way of seeing and understanding the natural world. That's never going to go away. Now, someday, it could be replaced by another myth. As Carl Sagan says in the article from Rolling Stone that I put a little bit of it in that chapter, you know, he very clearly says, oh, you know, science is our myth right now. See, he was using it in that correct way. And he says, well, do you mean the science could someday be replaced? Absolutely. This is Carl Sagan. Absolutely. Because with new knowledge, new understanding, we may understand the world in a whole different way, and it may create a whole new thing that we give the name to our knowledge. But the science aspect of this new emerging mythos is just one part. It's science and spirituality that emerge together in this new mythos. And it's very important to understand that science represents knowledge, spirituality, which represents wisdom, and wisdom is at the center. So you think of wisdom sort of like your nucleus, and science is sort of orbiting around. Because if you do it the other way, you see, it doesn't work. All the great scientists have seen that and said it in different ways. That you, if you have science and you take away, it doesn't function. You take that spiritual aspect away, it doesn't function. And all it does is become some ridiculous dualistic duel between science and religion. So, this new emerging mythos, which has been emerging for a while, is going to have wisdom at the center, spirituality at the center, and orbiting about it will be knowledge, science. And it, if it's not that way, you fall into an idolatry around science. It becomes an ism, scientism, where you have a new priesthood of those who speak the arcane language that the ordinary person doesn't speak. And only they really understand. And so they hold it close. And they make pronouncements as if they are prophets. And if there's anything this virus taught us, that there's way too much hubris in science and not enough humility. But you see, when science is in its proper place, orbiting wisdom, then it becomes a gift. Then it becomes a way to bring how things work together with why they matter. Because unless those two are together, we cannot move forward. We cannot evolve and open up into a more universal consciousness. It's not possible. You can't embrace with your heart what your mind rejects. So let me go into those four functions. Now, these four functions come from Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist. The first function is the metaphysical. And what is the metaphysical function? The metaphysical function is, it's all about the mystery. It's all about that thing which opens us up. It's about that sense of awe, which, as Sagan said in that quote, is both humbling and expanding at the same time. And it allows us to move into a different sense of identity, where we no longer associate or center ourselves in this very separate skin bag. We no longer see ourselves that way. We begin to see ourselves as the universe. And it's very profound. And it changes the way you feel about you think and feel about everything. Nothing is separate from you anymore. And you are everything. You are part of everything. And when you really begin to sort of let that marinate and fill you, it changes you. And everywhere you look, you see the connection. And it gets to a point where you can no longer see the separation. You understand it's there through delusion, but you no longer experience it. How do we practice that? Well, one great way to practice that is to make ourselves aware and understand the great majesty of this universe that we live in. And do that until the magic of it starts to penetrate our spirit. So that when we look into the night sky, there's a feeling of awe and reverence, and a feeling of knowing that there is no true separation. And when a person begins to experience that, and everybody has, sometimes they forget. Everybody has those experiences. We look at things differently, you know? It's like the old Zen saying, you know, what is the magic of living? Chop wood and carry water. The ordinary becomes sacred. There's no separation between the profane and the sacrosanct. It's one. And as I always sort of jokingly say, you know, but I mean it. You take these invisible elements like helium and hydrogen, and somehow through some incredible evolutionary alchemy, you end up with Hendrix and Hepburn. Now, if that doesn't godsmack you, then you're not seeing it. You're blind. Your eyes are not open. But when you realize that, you just want to stop people in the street. And that's what the metaphysic does. And how do we nurture that? We nurture it through exposing ourselves to learning and understanding and opening our hearts and minds to it. And then we bring it into our practice through things like what we're doing now, liturgy and meditation. And those practices which draw us into that mystical land of the true country. The second is the cosmological function. And the cosmological function is really our knowledge of how things work, wedded to why they matter. And so for me, that's kind of like the practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness understood as a system of spiritual technology that allows us to speak from that new mythos. So for example, if I'm teaching someone about the interdependence of all life, I can do that by giving them scientific examples, maybe through evolutionary studies, or maybe through genetic studies, or maybe the study of viruses, that I can show them that relationship. I can show them the wonders of how interdependence is so great in this thermodynamic universe, that the water that makes up most of my Pepsi at one time was drank by a velociraptor. That's magical, man. When I drink that Pepsi, that velociraptor, I feel that velociraptor. Ask her. And I can then show them, though, in a very easy and simple, practical way, after I've shown them how the whole universe that way, I can show them that their mind works that way. I can show them that everything they feel, every action they take or don't take, is interdependently linked with every thought and belief and every belief that was created and conditioned at some point. It never happens differently. It always flows in that same chain of causation. And when I want to try to help someone pastorally, I'm not going to tell them, honestly, lots of old fables and stories from a time before our knowledge of science. I'm going to use science because it's magical, man. I can easily comfort someone who's lost a loved one without ever referencing a sutra or referencing some old story from thousands of years ago. I can reference consciousness and the studies of consciousness and the fact that some of those brilliant people who study those subjects in our world, when you listen to them or you talk to them, if you have that opportunity, they're like mystics. They sound just like mystics. And I can do that without referring to any other old myth. And it really works. And in some ways it works more than the old myth. Why? Because our mind doesn't have to reject it. Our mind doesn't have to accept it, but our mind is more open to it because it doesn't conflict with everything else that we know. So that's the cosmological function. The next one is the sociological function. And the sociological function is the way within which it helps us to understand who we are together. And I think of it in many ways as providing the dance floor between chaos and order. It allows us to have a sense of order, have a sense that things fit. And we all have a rage for order, as my old friends from Queensrÿche used to say. We all have that rage for order. And yet at the same time, there's a part of us that rebels. So there's the right hand which creates order, there's the left hand which helps challenge it. And that tension is what we always want. Many of us are uncomfortable with that tension, whether it's in our own personal lives or it's in our larger society. It scares us. But that tension is where all evolution takes place. And so we need to embrace that tension. But we learn to do it in such a way is that there is a perimeter where there is a sort of, as we do here, we create this sacred space through which you can open up the other parts. Because if you don't have that, if you don't have that sacred foundation, that floor, then you really can't dance. You really can't do it. And I think of the way you bring this practice into place is you have to have some sort of vision. There's an old saying that where the people have no vision, they will perish. So you have to have a vision, a shared vision. And that's what this sociological function is about. And it allows this new mythos to sort of help us to find our way in that sense. And I think that oneness, as this new emergent mythos, allows us to do this. It allows us to do this. And there are examples that emerge. I'm a big fan of Star Trek. And I love Star Trek for so many reasons, unapologetically. But part of the reason I love it is it provides this sociological function. It gives us a vision of what is possible. And it allows us through little parables to explore the challenges and the tensions. That's profound, man. That's profound. And there is, you know, in the Star Trek world, there's the great intergalactic federation of planets. Okay? And there's a common value system. And every system like that is constantly helping us to move beyond tribal identity, where we focus on what makes us different rather than what makes us the same. And Star Trek does that. No, it's in the book, but the actual layout is universal liberty, equality, scientific development, space exploration, moving us beyond our limited identity. That's pretty cool. It's like the great one we have in this country, E Pluribus Unum. Out of the many, one. See, these are the things that the sociological structure builds. And this, the emerging mythos is one. And however we work that out, that is where the tension is, see? And that's the tension. But oneness points us in the same direction. That's what you find in things like Star Trek. And in our everyday life, I think that the precepts, like the precepts we take as a Sangha that guide us, or the vows, like the Bodhisattva vows, that's our value. You know, like companies have mission statements and value statements. Well, that's ours. The refuge, the refuge, the precepts, the vows, that's ours. But it provides that sociological function so then we can dance between chaos and order. And finally, there's the pedagogical function. And the challenge for us today, pedagogically, is that science learns spirit, and spirit speaks science. That there's no more the great divorce. Our new pedagogy, in essence, is that science speaks spirit, and spirit speaks through science. And that becomes the new pedagogy. And it's done out of, as I mentioned earlier, heuristic humility, not a harmful hubris. And these principles can help enlighten, liberate, and integrate the good, the bad, and the ugly. Any pedagogy which does not embrace the shadow, which does not embrace the good, the bad, and the ugly, is not whole and can never be whole. And it's a challenge, man. It's a challenge. When an individual comes to me and says, Sensei, I'm hurting, I'm suffering, help me. I have a pedagogy that I apply. And that pedagogy for me is the three principles of oneness and the four direction system of mindfulness. That's my pedagogy. But the greatest thing that I have to present to this person is that I have to help them somewhere, somehow integrate all the aspects of themselves that they want to leave out, that they want to erase. And every time I work with someone, you can see that it is the past they're wrestling with. Every individual. And the pedagogy helps them to reveal the past in a new way. Because the old way is to bring the past in as either something that I feel really guilty about, or the past is something that I long for, a nostalgia that doesn't bring me joy, but brings me sadness, a desire to go back to when it was better. And so that's the two things you find, those who are guilty about the past and those that are looking backwards as if it was perfect. And so what you have to gently do is help them to realize that you can't erase the past. You can't push it off like it didn't happen. And it does not serve you to wallow in it, to come like some creature before a malevolent God on bloody knees, begging for forgiveness. Because all that does is further entrench the ego self. And it's really not about anyone else. It's about me trying to make myself clean by forgetting, by pretending that the ugly and the bad are not part of me. And the other challenge is for the person who has the paradisical perfection in the past, and helping them realize that whatever they thought they knew about the past was a fantasy and totally unreliable. And they learn to integrate the shadow. They learn to integrate those things, learn from those things. And the biggest thing they can do in the present is not to try to rebuild the past or pretend that the past can be wiped out, but integrate it in a new way so that one takes a new direction. If there are things in the past that were wrecking our lives, then we move in a new direction. If there were things in our past that we thought were glorious, then we analyze what that would mean today. We look at how can I bring that same joie de vivre, that same spirit to now. Because I can't go back. I can't change. And that's the challenge. So the pedagogical function probably in some ways becomes the most important, because it's how we engage with our lives. It's how we bring to bear this wisdom. And the fruit of it is compassion. So those are the four functions of oneness. And how each of us learns to sort of integrate that in our own lives is what makes up our unique path. And our work, my work, the work of teachers, is to help each person to bring that mythos into their life, into their culture, into their life.